This is the Average Guy Network, and you have found Home Gadget Geek, show number 606 with Christian Johnson, recorded on May 2nd, 2024. Here on Home Gadget Geeks, we cover all the favorite tech gadgets that find their way into your home, news, reviews, product updates, and conversation, all for the average tech guy. I'm your host, Jim Cawson, broadcasting live from the AverageGuy.tv studios here in a beautiful Bellevue, Nebraska. Many of you contacted me last week. I appreciate that. We in Omaha get tornadoes, I don't know, every 5 or 6 years. It's not every year. In Oklahoma, it's every year. In Nebraska, 5 or 6, 7 maybe. And man, we had some storms come through.
Twisters. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we had some damage. Fortunately, Bellevue, I live on the east side of kind of the tornado alley up here, and no damage, so we were fine. But I appreciate many of you guys checked in with me and said, "Hey, everything okay?" And we were fortunate. We of course are, you know, thoughts, prayers, and positive vibes go out to our friends on the other side of the city. Mm-hmm. Where we did, I don't know, 246 damaged homes and 167 completely destroyed, like something like that. So lots of rebuilding going on. The great thing is Omaha is a really good community, and they were, I think at one point kind of turning volunteers away. They're like, okay, we're good. This is obnoxious now. We don't have enough water to keep you hydrated through the time. So we had a good community. Of course, we'll post a show with some world-class show notes out at theaverageguy.tv. Big thanks to our Patreon subscribers as well. If you're a part of that Patreon team, thank you. If you're not, you can join us at theaverageguy.tv/Patreon. And then big thanks to Jay Franzi, who joined me 2 weeks ago. I took last week off. We had an office party, but 2 weeks ago, Jay joined me. And Jay, thanks for jumping in here. It was a fun show. We had a good time, and appreciate you, Jay, for being on the program. You've already heard him, but Christian's here tonight. And Christian, welcome back.
Hey, good to be back. It's been, I don't know, we did maybe 2 months ago.
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago.
Not too bad.
No, I thought, well, I'll get you back in here anytime. I kind of open it up when I've got an open schedule. I kind of give you first dibs. So I ping you and say, hey, you can take anything in here, and you give me a date, and then we go from there. So that kind of works out well. Any updates on Maple Grove Partners? What do you guys been up to over there?
It's fulfilling its mission. Status quo. We've had some new customer faces show up. Haven't been too heavy on hardware upgrades in the last quarter. But we have plenty of capacity, and our uptime has been fantastic. Uptime statistics are definitely looking really good for this year. So been pretty happy with that.
How many hard drives do you think you have in the, if you were to count a general number of, I get the Backblaze quarterly report, right? I'm on their email, and they categorize all the hard drives that they have by model. And then they give you a failure rate, which is kind of cool. They wouldn't have to do that, right? But for us data nerds, right, we kind of like to keep track of that kind of stuff. How many hard drives do you think you got? And does it give you, like, to get a feel for, like, oh, 4 terabyte drives are starting to go, we're going to replace them with 8. I'm making that up, but yeah. Do you think about that?
We do. So on production web servers, we build anything from smaller web nodes, which are going to be like 2 SSDs or NVMEs in RAID 1, to larger VM nodes, which can be up to 8 SSDs or NVMEs in a usually a RAID 5 or 6 configuration. Both production and in personal collection, we're probably well over 120 drives, and actually the bulk majority of them are 6 terabyte and 10 terabyte drives. But a lot of that is, you know, for fun. The actual production capacity and number of drives needed is a bit less. And the drive technology is, you know, definitely changing somewhat faster than the web ecosystem keeps up with it. So, yeah, your fastest web server node is undoubtedly going to be writing directly to an NVMe on a motherboard. But in terms of what's the easiest setup to actually scale web nodes, it's actually super cheap and super scalable to just throw a bunch of SSDs into a RAID configuration and let it roll. So we still do that actually for a good number of web nodes, and the data rates are totally sufficient that it's going to be comparable to writing to a single NVMe, but then you don't have to worry about the durability and redundancy of the data. So in terms of drive failures, we've been pretty fortunate in that regard. We've had some, I think our longest running storage system that we've built at Maple Grove is it's one of our older RAID clusters. It is a SAS enclosure that has 8 2-terabyte drives in it. And we built that box back in 2008. Oh, wow. And it's had like 2 drive failures over its life, which is like stupidly good for 16 years of runtime. We've just, you know, kind of locked that technology. So like we always replace it with the exact hardware model of the failed drive. We don't like mix and match drives and clusters. So that is the longest running workhorse. It's a 15-year-old storage cluster. Crazy. And there's no like strong or compelling reason to run it. Like we could turn it off tomorrow if we wanted to, but you know, why kill your oldest workhorse? It's kind of cool.
Can't be terribly energy. I mean, there's gotta be more energy efficient ways, or you think
just yeah. I mean, definitely. But you know, a lot of these boxes, you don't, especially for like storage clusters, you don't need to always have them running on demand. You can always have them, you can have different storage clusters do wake ups for like cold storage versus warm storage. So, as they get older and older, we can change the runtime on those boxes to basically be when you need it. And, usually we try to take our secondary hardware and use it more for like secondary backups so that like we're not relying on like, you know, the mission critical stuff going on the oldest hardware. But it's still a cheap way to get secondary backup and redundancy. So why not?
Yeah. 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 Ron, from Canada, one of our listeners sent me an email and he basically asked me, hey, if you were buying a NAS today for personal use, so not, you know, not server storage, not Maple Grove partner stuff, but if you were buying a NAS for yourself, let's say you were going to, you know, most people 4 terabytes is plenty, but he may do Blu-rays. So maybe you want to get it up to 12. Those can be large. What would you use today? If you were building a NAS box, what would you do? Do you think?
It's a hard question because in some respects, NAS boxes are tricky because I think a good number of them burn through drives quicker. And the reason I say that is because I still think the smaller form factors of NAS just run at a higher operating temperature, which means the drives are going to burn out quicker. You could factor in how often you think you're going to be replacing those drives, but generally, like even on our old school toasters that we used where, yeah, our quickest burnout rate was on those small boxes.
Those were HP boxes.
Yeah, the media smarts.
Media smart servers.
Yeah. That we then like replaced the old single core Celeron. We flashed the firmware on the motherboard, got it to a quad core Intel, I think. And yeah, we made really cool servers out of them from what they were in the old days. But yeah, I would probably just go with the highest density storage I could get for a NAS at the time of purchase, knowing that it's going to move, you know, some, you know, next order of magnitude from where it was purchased. So like today, 18 terabyte drives would probably be that sweet spot to put in a NAS. And, you know, again, it depends what you want to do with it. Depends what your budget is, et cetera. But if it was just like money is no object and you want to buy a moderately sized NAS that you're going to run for 5 to 10 years and not think about, then yeah, I'd be looking at 18 terabytes or north. Yeah. 10 is a super cheap price point. I mean, 10 terabytes is like, yeah, if you're looking for something more economical that gives you density, like 10 is an easy button. 10 or 12 is an easy button. But in terms of like you want the most storage for the single effort build, I would be north of 18.
Would you go like, would you 2, 3 drive, 4 drive bay? Does it matter? Would you, you know, for redundancy? What kind of, what would you look at? There's tons of options right now. Like NAS is, they're a dime a dozen out there. Synology, QNAP, Ugreen, the company that, that I, the very first battery backup, you know, I bought a big battery backup in here to be a, like a solar generator to be the battery backup. I wanted it to last an hour, not 5 minutes type deal. Right. Ugreen, that company, they're making a NAS. They're getting into that space. And I thought, how weird to be getting into NASs now.
Yeah.
Like I thought, right? You know?
Yeah. Especially with the cost of like cloud storage too.
Yeah. Now, in Ron's case, he wants to rip some Blu-rays and have them local. So would you, you know, say 10 terabytes is a sweet spot. Do you buy a 4-bay NAS of some kind, load 2 in and maybe put a third in, or what's your strategy there?
So I'm a weirdo, but I, 8 is our sweet spot. Cause I always want to be able to handle 2 drive failures in a single box, because it is really easy to have one drive go bad and you'll be like, oh, that sucks, but hey, it's all good. And then you order the replacement drive and it comes in a couple of weeks. And like, I've had it happen before where you lose that second drive in the same time because the thermals and wear and properties, like it's not a 0% chance that you lose 2 drives consecutively in a short period of time. So personally, I'm a big fan of 8. Cause I think it gives you, whether you're doing
8 drives.
Yeah.
8 drives.
Cause you know, yeah, it's more space, but at the point you're telling me you're willing to put a box in your house and do this kind of thing, like space probably isn't the highest concern, at that point. And yeah, like the power runtime's a bit higher, but, it's probably anywhere from 3 to 10 watts per drive at idle.
We figure 5. That's a good.
Yeah. So, okay. It's like an extra couple light bulbs running. And I don't think that's terribly a bad trade-off for getting the increase in both storage and durability that you get going to 8 drives versus the 4. The 4 is fine, but you're probably looking at something like a, if you wanted the 2-drive redundancy, you'd be doing something more like RAID 1 with a lot of mirrors, which is fine, but then your density drops substantially. And so if you're going to be, you know, doing something like, oh, I'm going to rip a bunch of Blu-rays, probably don't want to be relying on that type of strategy. Mm-hmm. Now, something like Blu-rays also, I suppose, are re-rippable, right? If you own all of them and you need to rehost them, but that's a big pain in the butt to have to go back through all that effort. So
yeah. All right, Ron, there you go. There's some things to start chewing on as you're listening to it. And certainly, I mean, there's, like you said, Christian, there's 100 different ways to do this. Kind of depends on how much you want to spend. you know, availability of drives and where you're at. I mean, you could, in your scenario, say you were going to go eight, you're going to spend the majority on the box itself. An eight drive box is going to cost you a little bit. But then, you know, you may want to think you can, if you want to source it with inexpensive available drives, 6 and 8 terabyte drives right now are pretty available in that space, and they're going to be available for a while. So if you needed to have a hot backup, you could either buy 9 drives and have a spare, or the chances of you in a year or two being able to pick up a very similar drive of that size, maybe even say model.
Yes.
You know, you can, the availability of those, remember, there's a lot of companies that are using these in their space. They're swapping them out with the 12 and 16 terabyte drives now. And those drives are all coming down. You know, you get them on eBay through some hard drive and, you know, hard drive resellers. And they've just been spinning. That's all they've really been doing for, you know, for a while. They test them out. So there's some, and you can get them pretty inexpensively. That's kind of the way I bought a bunch of 4 terabyte drives. I don't know, when I started doing Chia, 3-4 years ago, maybe. And they just keep spinning, you know, just haven't had, and they were not new. You know, they were coming off these wherever they get them from, who knows. But you can, the cool thing is they have so many of them. You can often find, you know, like I could buy almost five of the same, you know, 4 RAID, you know, 4 setup, buy 5 of them, you get a better deal. And then keep one around as a spare. It's a hot spare. Just set it on top. Yeah. So you've got it, right? In your case, one goes bad, it's going to rebuild. That rebuild process may push a second one to the brink. So one fails, order another one, immediately swap it out, right? With the hot swap, there may even be some warranty left on the drive. And then wait for that second one to come in.
What a sick joke, though, about the second drive getting weakened by the rebuild and then potentially knocking you out.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I guess in that theory, if you were going to go 4 and not 8, you should probably have 2 available for hot swap at that point, right? Have them both on hand. Lessens the odds if one does go bad that you can at least get it quicker. You're not waiting for one to come in the mail.
Yeah.
You know, so, not at what everybody wants to hear, but I mean, if you're going to go into that space, go in eyes wide open. I have long since stopped ripping anything locally. We literally, it was funny tonight. Well, probably, and I hate to admit this, 2 weeks ago, Sarah, we have an NVIDIA Shield that we use as our kind of our media device on the TV. It's overkill, but it works just fine. And it's getting a little long in the tooth at this point. She's like, hey, it's not working anymore. And I'm like, well, okay, before we do some things, let me just troubleshoot it. Well, I never got to it. So tonight she was like, hey, I have an extra Roku thing laying around. She's like, can you put that Roku on there so I can, you know, do some stuff? And I'm like, oh, sorry. Let me just test it. So I unplugged and plugged both the HDMI cables back. It came right back up. You're like, there you go. So you never.
What are you going to do if that box goes on you?
It's not serving. I mean, we don't have any, we're not storing any media. I use channels and we've got storage servers for that. But if it goes, I'd put Roku on it and I'd throw it away or I'd recycle it. And I've got an extra Roku that I could throw on there and that'd be fine. You know, we can get to everything through the Roku box. That's one of the advantages. I'll be honest with you. I bought last year I bought a TV for the deck and it's got Roku built into it. But if that goes bad, you know, I mean, it's got HDMI. I could put another Roku on it, I guess. It's, you know, whatever media stick you want to add, but it's built into the TV, you know? And so you're like, in this case, we bought this TV the year before all of that stuff started getting built in. So it literally is a dumb TV. It doesn't do very much, but so yeah, I think we just throw Roku box on there and call it good. I don't know. What would you Got any suggestions? What would you do?
It's funny. We still have the HD home run tuners on the network for
we do too.
Television. We got so worried about them going out of business that we bought like spares of the tuner so that if the tuner ever dies, we can just like, it's there swap just it. Like a hard drive, just swap it right out. I'll be sad the day like either those or the cable cards themselves stop becoming a thing. But outside of that, we're not watching a whole lot of stuff on cable anymore anyway. So it's, any amount of money being sacrificed to Netflix and Apple to get their content and Prime. And then there's a couple that we rotate in and out of, but I mean, we're not, the days of like recording all the things and storing all the things for like entertainment television, we're just not doing it anymore. Which is a weird thing to be saying, but here we are. Streaming has completed its takeover.
Well, and listen, I rarely watch anything in its entirety. I watch the clips, like a new movie will come out and I'll just watch the best of the movie on YouTube in pieces. And you can put the story together and I might watch a review, somebody who's reviewing the movie to, you know, there's the media clip guys and whatever who do these reviews and they'll go through the whole movie. So I get a premise for kind of, okay, here's what the movie's supposed to be about. And then I'll just watch the clips and get the best parts of the movie without having to go through all the slow parts. And, I was thinking the other day, I'm not sure I could sit through a 2-hour movie anymore. Just kind of lost patience with it. Brian says sports, and this is true. Sports is the main reason, for cable, but even that is, it's, you know, the other night, the basketball game, the March Madness, the championship was on. I had some friends over. We were on the deck. They were like, hey, can you get the game on? I'm like, I don't know. And it was because it wasn't on network. And we don't have cable, so I can't get ESPN through the cable provider or whatever. Sign in through the apps. Well, Sarah had bought Max. She'd subscribed to Max. And Max had a deal with somebody. And we got the basketball game on Max. Never in a million years, which used to be HBO, did I think I would watch a sporting event on HBO. You know, and you're like, well, you know, okay. And they're all tied together, like Hulu and Disney Plus, and they're all sleeping with each other and you're not sure who's who anymore. And they're changing their names. And so kind of like, I don't know, what's it going to be on? And, I was surprised that the finals were not on network television. And you're like, well, I guess that's where we're going with this. You know, how long before the Super Bowl stops being on network
television? They're doing Thursday Night Football on Prime now, so that feels like a matter of time before it expands. I don't know,
but you're right. I mean, it's just, it's kind of, now you're thinking like, you have to start thinking like, okay, I want to watch this, where is it at?
Yeah, who do I go to?
Do I have it? Do I have it, you know, is it subscribed? Can I go through someone else to get it?
I read something interesting too, that like a lot of the streaming providers are now starting to cut back on their original content production, not just because of how expensive it is, but because they have so much freaking content. Like someone signing up for the service, like, what, you mean to tell me you're going to have watched the entire library of Netflix, and that if there's not some new hot thing that comes out, they're not going to be buying a subscription? And like, I don't know what percentage of like a Netflix customer or a Paramount customer are people who are just buying it for a specific thing they want to watch, then canceling it and then buying it again. Like, I know those people are out there, but I think probably a large majority of people let those subscriptions ride and just don't even think about it. If you're maybe trying to cut costs or whatever, that's a different story. But I think the average person just, you know, wanting to have access to content and not think about it too hard, I don't think they're starving to find content because there's a lot out there.
Yeah. Well, and I watch now on Sundays, I watch one game live. That's the first one. And then I can start going, then I can go to YouTube and I can literally watch because the NFL takes the shortened version, just the best plays, and pushes that to YouTube in a 10-minute recap. Mm. Why would I watch the whole game with commercials when I can watch it on YouTube on Brave, commercial free, and not like I could watch all the games instead of just a handful in that. Now I don't, but the ones that matter. And I just found it, it's actually less stressful to watch it that way than in real time. I don't know what it is. I don't enjoy, you know, that's one, it's a 3-hour commitment if you're going to watch the whole thing, right? Mm-hmm. And I've done in 10 minutes on YouTube. So I wonder if they're doing that for baseball. I haven't looked into that for Major League Baseball. I'm sure they are. I have to see if those are available on YouTube. Or hockey would be another one to watch a shortened version of, you know, and it's much more enjoyable. You get to the, and I sometimes even fast forward through those. Like, I'm like, yeah, nah, 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 nah. And on some games, I don't even, you know, I'll hit play and then I'll drag it to the end. Just so now, okay, how dumb is this? I could go to any sports website and see what the scores are, but you're there on YouTube, hit play. Scroll. Oh, here's the end. That's the score. Boom. Move on to the next one, you know. So I don't know. My TV, my watching habits are bizarre now.
Yeah.
It's not like it used to be. Yeah.
Nope. Streaming has ruined it.
Well, and streaming and YouTube have ruined it. I just have this.
So do you use YouTube TV then?
I don't. Yeah. No, just regular YouTube. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Right on.
And there's a ton of content on there, and it's all free.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I watch anytime I want to watch a, you know, bourbon review, or I follow some DIYers, or you know, I'm fascinated with people building houses, but only up to a point. Like, I watch repair videos too, where they come in and take an old house and like really fix it up. But yeah, like, once they get into the detail work, I'm out. Like, I don't want to watch a hang drywall, and I want to see the major repairs, you know? And
sure.
So anyways, yeah. Yeah. I'm just looking at with the tornadoes last week, I watched a few of those on YouTube, and I watched the live storm chasers.
Wowza.
Dude, they have gotten,
that is bold. A wowza.
They have gotten bold. Like, there was one, he was out and you could hear the shotgun, you know, the alternate guy in the car going, "We need to turn around right now." He's like, "It's fine. It'll just be a second." The driver, "It'll just be a second. It's going to be okay." And the other dude is just freaking out.
Yeah.
Live. Right. Just freaking out. And you kind of feel sorry for the guy. You're like, dude, that is a tornado that will absolutely take you out. And they are getting close. And I noticed they're starting to armor plate some of their cars and stuff to kind of, you know, they've got kind of stuff on them for damage. And it's a whole nother world, but you could watch it right there on YouTube. There's now at any given time, there are storm chasers. This is the time of the year. That's ironically,
truly our baseball wild team
is called the Omaha Storm Chasers. That's our AAA baseball team, the Storm Chasers. No, you can just watch. You could watch live storm chasing all any afternoon in the spring, and they're in some part of the country: Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, Nebraska, Iowa, chasing storms. Yeah, that's crazy. Anyways, well, let's talk. You got some show notes. Let's talk a little private 5G. What is private 5G?
It's the opposite of public 5G. No, it's a weird one. I always, as you know, like to bring technology that people are maybe not always paying attention to that I think is disruptive. And I do think this is an area that probably not as revolutionary as AI, but when I talk about all the different infrastructure that enables you know, top technologies like AI, this is a really interesting one. So private 5G in a nutshell is the actual act of you as a business or entity, we'll just say an entity, you can go and procure basically your own 5G network, and you set up the cell tower and the network and all the IP stuff gets set up. And then, you know, you bring whatever hardware you want to that network, as long as it can get basically a SIM card in it. You get on that network and you have your own, literally your own private 5G capability up to a certain range, right? So obviously a lot of these big enterprise sellers of private 5G, you can pick different, you know, do I want a 3 mile radius, you know, 1 mile radius, like how big of a network do you need? And so I find it really interesting for a few reasons. But one of the areas that it's being disruptive in that I don't know is really on the average guy's radar at all, that I just think is kind of cool, is that they're doing a lot with 5G right now, private 5G specifically in the manufacturing space. And so when you talk about, like, you know, how AI is automating a lot of stuff that's going on in the industrial, you know, workroom floor, where there's all these robotic arms and other things that are doing, you know, sorting and building and soldering and sorting and, you know, any number of tasks. All of that machinery or robotics needs a network to get its, you know, command signals, et cetera, on. And historically, that's been any amount of jumble of Ethernet and or Wi-Fi. And it's pretty expensive to set it up and get it right and then have, you know, this army of network engineers trying to maintain your industrial network. And what a lot of kind of manufacturing firms are finding is that they're revamping their workroom floors by just getting rid of all of their hardwired and wireless technology entirely and just moving to private 5G, and that they're able to hire people to run and manage their private 5G network, but that otherwise it's substantially more efficient, cost effective, and performant to just deploy a 5G network and have that be what runs the entire manufacturing floor, which is fascinating, right? And one of the real interesting success stories of private 5G in corporate America is John Deere, who, you know, no one would ever think of John Deere as a tech company. But in many ways, they really are a smart player in this space. And one of the things they did when no one else was really doing it was they were buying up spectrum space on the cheap. So they, you know, like in 2020, they were still buying up, you know, a half a million for spectrum space, and then moving their factory's connectivity over to that, to a private implementation, that, you know, they were in the game back when it was still 4G LTE was the private concept. And then they upgraded to 5G, but, you know, they were one of the early adopters of this concept of private cell phone networks being a more viable ecosystem for them than traditional networks. And, when you think about not just like John Deere, the, you know, company producing all these different types of heavy machinery, heavy equipment, but you also think about just the agriculture industry in general, where, you know, they have to deploy a bunch of sensors and, you know, whether that's weather or temperature or water or whatever, you have all these random sensors that you're dealing with in enterprise agriculture. They're also finding it's a very, you know, cheap and cost-effective way to connect a bunch of things to a grid that otherwise have no infrastructure or mechanism to do so cheaply. So I just thought that was a cool thing to put on people's radar, because it's not inconceivable, right? From an average guy perspective, you know, we've seen like Verizon, you can now buy 5G home internet. A lot of folks, I think, in the community, I know you have like the T-Mobile 5G mm-hmm. internet, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In a weird way, that is a, it is a ever so slight variant of private 5G. But I could see it going further where, you know, you start having maybe local neighborhoods or local networks of, hey, I'm going to, you know, we're going to buy fiber optic in this area, especially like in rural areas still where we're, you know, we're still talking about, we're still having the conversation in 2024 about how to get parts of the country online. Right. Yeah. I could totally see
less with,
could totally envision parts of rural America, basically, pooling up and saying, okay, we're going to like have this internet 5G thing in our community and start handing out SIM cards to everyone in the neighborhood and call it a day. Mm-hmm. And that almost being something that's managed privately within that community. The other thing that's really interesting about it is they're now looking at, there's a company now that's looking at, they offer a version of private 5G that is hardened against EMP, which is really fascinating because everyone is so terrified about, well, what happens when there's an EMP attack or a grid issue or whatever, and all the cell phones and comms get knocked offline. And so what's interesting is that this company is basically taking the spin or the angle of, well, we actually think we have a solution where EMP resistant and hardened private 5G networks can bridge that gap. And that opens up a lot of use cases, whether it's anything from, you know, defense to healthcare industry, where you need like this high reliability in times of, you know, denial of availability. There's not a lot of people who probably are thinking about one, private 5G, and then two, like hardening private 5G to the point where you can use it as failover networks. So, you know, when your main Verizon, T-Mobile, whatever goes down, and oh yeah, I can just swap in my, you know, 5G neighborhood SIM card and still get to people I need to talk to. That's kind of an interesting concept. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of this is still fairly, you know, the market for it is a $1 billion market, but the trend of how long it's going to take for this market to grow at size is nothing that like blows my mind, right? So in 2023, the global private 5G market was valued at $2 billion, which is not, I don't know, it's not crazy. But it is expected to reach close to $12 billion by 2028. So, okay, kind of interesting. I think this is one of those technologies that is not obvious or is not going to hockey stick at the speed of like what we've seen with LLMs and whatnot, but is still like one of those interesting things to keep on your radar and check in on now and again, because it has some potential. And yes, people are having success with the use cases now, but I could see it being, I could see it being more integrated in a lot of the discussion around how to keep evolving infrastructure to be more resilient at the very least. And then when you start looking at what I would call AI at the edge, right? Like you're going to want to start getting AI applications into all these things that are hard to connect. Like imagine, you know, AI is helping you optimize your agriculture to get the highest yield possible, and wanting to have that analysis be able to connect to your private 5G network to automatically kind of tune your stuff, right? That brings, you know, the buzzword of 5 to 7 years ago about Internet of Things, like it brings that into a new context of like, oh, we've been through Internet of Things, we've been through cloud, we've been through securing all those things. We've been through scaling, getting the bandwidth for all those things. And oh, now we're getting to the point where we can push that connectivity with the level of availability and elasticity that we need out to things that otherwise are very annoying to get connected at speed. And oh yeah, we can now connect that infrastructure to the same kind of AI mothership, if you will, to have really cool world outcomes. So I put private 5G right now in the category of infrastructure enabler. And yes, it is very enterprise focused right now. But I do think you could see some really interesting ways that this unfolds in the years to come.
Does the inherent, so in the article, Deere picked up, you know, one of these, this, whatever they picked up for $500,000, $500,000. To me, you know, you think, okay, and they're replacing their current infrastructure, Ethernet, Wi-Fi, and LTE. The goal says to go from their current split of 70% wired, 30% Wi-Fi to 80% mobile, 10% Wi-Fi, and 10% Ethernet. Is it really that much more expensive on the Wi-Fi wired side? I guess if you're thinking of cabling and Wi-Fi's range, you're talking about more equipment, right, to get there. A 5G tower, so to speak, is going to have a giant reach as opposed to what Wi-Fi could have inside of a building. Does that math, that is that how the math lines up? It's just...
Yeah, I mean, I think range is the range and bandwidth are the biggest things, yeah, right? Yeah. Like even with really good outdoor Wi-Fi, you're only going to get a subset. Even in your when you're in these big manufacturing floors, you know, you can be dealing with noisy neighbor and other types of congestion issues. So that is a main driver, but I do think also just the cost of and form factor of getting it down to a SIM card and an antenna. Right. Yeah. That's not to say we don't have really small Wi-Fi chips as well, but those small Wi-Fi chips then are going to have less range, less bandwidth, you know, need to be closer to an access point. Yeah. Whereas you don't necessarily have that limitation with a 5G installation. Mm-hmm. So those are all outright overt benefits. Cost wise, it's hard to see it getting more expensive. I do think this gets cheaper over time, and what order of magnitude though is not yet really clear. You know, for example, I don't know what is involved in, you know, some people probably have to deal with acquiring their own spectrum. Other people are probably using spectrum that they're getting, right? So like, for example, Amazon actually offers a managed private 5G service where basically you can define what you need in terms of like coverage and capacity and number of devices, et cetera, and then turn that into an order for, hey, here's your hardware, here's your tower, et cetera, and activate it and run with it. And so, you know, there's examples like that where you're probably able to not have to think about things like, oh, I got to bring spectrum to this, as opposed to using spectrum that other providers have already purchased. But those are things that I think are largely doable, especially for enterprise. Like just looking at the pricing on like Amazon's 5G, they quote a 3-year cost of $287,000 for 3 years, and that includes basically a 5G radio unit. And then it includes some data transfer in and out charges, right? But I mean, essentially, for what an initial deployment of 5G is for a 1-year cost around $46,000, like that's a lot more economical even today than you would, you would think about for trying to do something like that 5 years ago.
For sure. Is a 5G, a private 5G network inherently more secure than running that same equipment on a public network, but that might be running through, you know, proprietary software, VPN, whatever, to, you know, say you have some products that does it always make sense to go private, or can it run public?
I do think that's one of the really cool things about it. Like, if you truly don't want anyone on your network, and you want to be kind of isolated from the internet, you know, there's nothing that says you have to put internet on that 5G network, right? Yeah. So from that perspective, the security of the network is as good as the over-the-air encryption and the capability of 5G, which, you know, hopefully we're not reading any headlines about 5G OTAs being decrypted anytime soon, right? So is it better than a VPN tunnel? It depends how you're measuring success, right? So certainly the VPN can help you protect the confidentiality of the data in transit and the, you know, your usage patterns. But again, it's to who, right? Because, you know, technically that means now the VPN provider might have some metadata on your usage. It might not exclude your ISP, you know, understanding things like who your VPN providers are or what your utilization patterns are or what times of day that traffic is showing up, right? So like all of that ancillary metadata about usage just completely disappears out of the picture when it's this truly kind of isolated network from, you know, anything that requires basically creating a private network on top of public networks, which is what the VPN is doing. And that, you know, even if you have a really good secure VPN, and I'm not advocating for VPNs for general use, right? But even those solutions leave breadcrumbs, right?
Yeah. Another hop you don't have to worry about, right?
Yeah.
And you could isolate that network in its own way from the internet, or feed only what you need to get at the base of the internet in, give it an additional block or whatever you're trying to do there. That's interesting. Yeah, I never thought. All of a sudden, I was thinking, should I get a 5G tower on my house?
Well, yes. Really? Well, you know, and it's funny too, because I always thought it was really cool when I bought the
Yes, way too fast, by the way.
We both said yes way too fast. Yes. I was excited. But I was excited when I bought the iPhone. This is the XS Plus. So I've had this now for like, I guess, 5 years, and it still feels like a new iPhone, which is kind of scary. But the thing I thought was really cool about this was it has the dual SIM ports in it, right? So you can easily add a second carrier in it. And I'm like, cool. Wouldn't it be really nice if you had your public 5G and then you could just pop in your private 5G card and rock and roll? That would be sweet. That would be really sweet.
Be good coverage. Be great coverage.
Yeah.
There's nowhere on your property you could go and get away from it. It would be everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're fortunate enough. My 5G tower is a block away. So, I mean, I have a little bit of an unfair advantage by buying this T-Mobile service.
That's awesome, though. I mean, that's what it's for.
Just crushes it. And I'm, you know, I'm on the cheap $50 plan, and I'm getting, you know, 700. It's not gigabit, but I don't need that, right? I am getting 30 or 40, 50 sometimes up, which is what I really am more interested in. It works great. No latency. It's the perfect, I'm not sure I would have done it if I wasn't this close to the tower, you know? And so it works out pretty well that way. But you think about John Deere, you think about an Amazon distribution center, the larger ones, we've a couple here. They're probably too small for that kind of stuff, but you know, those kinds of big physical plant, I mean, John Deere's facilities are giant.
Yeah.
They are just absolutely giant, you know, and you think, oh, yeah, okay, well, that kind of makes sense. Well, that's good. What else? Anything else you'd add to that?
On the 5G tidbit, no. But yeah, hopefully it was something different. I don't know that I've ever talked about 4G or 5G at great length in that particular vein on the show before. No. So thought it was something different.
Yeah, no, it's good. And it makes sense in some ways as we think about, listen, it's a little crazy to think about putting your own 5G tower in. I get that. I would seriously do that. But that doesn't sound so crazy anymore as it did maybe 10 years ago or 15 years ago. And you think, I mean, it gets me thinking, like, are the days of Wi-Fi numbered? You know, or could we, now in my scenario, could I do something with T-Mobile and route everything through, could I rent a private network basically from T-Mobile?
Right.
Or something along those lines. I don't know if it's, I don't know how any of that works, if that's even possible. But for me, I get a better T-Mobile signal in some spots than I get in the house for Wi-Fi, you know?
Yeah.
Like I've been doing all this stuff to try and get Wi-Fi out to the shed so I can basically just take the computer out there, turn it on, it connects, and getting the signal from here, my house, through concrete walls out to the shed via Wi-Fi has been, without putting in really expensive, listen, there's expensive repeaters you could buy, and I could do that and make that work great.
What generation Wi-Fi are you dealing with?
That's a good question. I guess it's Wi-Fi 5G, right? That would be, we have a version of that in 2.4 and 5.0. Is that right? Am I getting those numbers right?
Yeah. Those are the bands, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But then
I don't have six. We're not on 6 or 6E yet. Yeah.
Got it.
No, I have a computer that has 6E, but I haven't upgraded any of my, by the way, I took a 6E Wi-Fi router that was like $600 a year ago, maybe when I was doing all this stuff, and the price just dropped down to $399. So we're starting to see some of that the 6E stuff. And you know, I wonder how far 7 is behind.
Well, Wi-Fi 7 is pretty much out. Which is why even now 6E, it's through the moon. Don't get me wrong. But it's just starting to put pressure on 6E. But yeah, the Wi-Fi 7 standard, they're talking 46 gigabits per second.
Yeah.
Which is like, I mean, that's like InfiniBand speeds, hardwired. No, I'm not saying theoretically you're going to get that, right? But new spectrum, more penetration of the signal. And I think they really look at Wi-Fi 7 as kind of the standard for when homes are 10 gig Ethernet, which is super funny. Because if we really want to be selfish and nerdy, I check like every month or so to see if Verizon multi-gig has come into our area, because they expanded their rollout of the 2 gigabit per second service outside of New York City, where it's been for a while. So I think we got to be getting close, but that's really the first time you can get asymmetric 2 gigabit per second up and down. And that puts you on a 10 gig path, right? Because you're going to have to get a new ONT for that. You're going to have to move to, I guess you could do the 2.5 gig Ethernet in the house if you really wanted, but, you're probably going to go to 10 gig.
Yeah.
And, guys are getting like anywhere from 2.3 to 2.6 gigabits per second with the plan, even though it's, rated for 2, because Verizon always oversubscribes from what their, limit is that they're selling you. So I just thought that was all really good.
Joe says out in chat, he says, I don't think the Wi-Fi is going anywhere anytime soon. The big three have pretty much stagnated on 5G deployment around central Arkansas. And well, but Joe, so to wrap up my story, I didn't quite get to the end of that. So I've been doing all these things to use kind of residential grade equipment to get a signal out to the shed. So TP-Link extenders. I didn't try any of the extenders where you plug them in, you plug it in and it extends it through the power line. Cause I'm running an extension cord out to the shed. I was like, it's probably not going to work. So, it's poor, but every time I can take my phone out of my pocket and just create a hotspot, and cause the tower is so close, I just get kicking signal in the shed off my phone. And so, I don't know. It's always just as we talk about these 5G private, I was like, that just for me, it'd actually be more convenient if I could subscribe to the tower as my network and attach all of my devices to the tower so that no matter where I'm at in this area, it's my network. And there'd be some real benefits to that with, as an example, we just got this brand new hummingbird feeder that's got cameras on it, right? We'll be talking about it in June when Aaron Lawrence comes back. But I don't move the pictures to the cloud. It's private. It's close. It's mm-hmm. here. Mm-hmm. But if I sometimes want to see those pictures, and I guess there's some hoops I could jump through to tunnel in. But if I'm in the shed and I'm not on the network, get off, get on the network kind of thing. Yeah, but I guess that's what I'm saying is I wouldn't mind having my own 5G network. That would be pretty cool.
Would be pretty cool.
And I guess I would realize the same thing that John Deere is seeing, that, hey, having your whole facility on that kind of makes things a little bit easier. I was going to show you then, this is the router, and I don't know if I'd ever buy this one, but this TP-Link.
It's a monster.
Yeah, this is kind of the one I put in my cart. I don't know about you, but I put things that I want to follow in my cart, and then the store will tell me.
Movement.
Right, yeah. Right? It's awesome. Like, that is, you're like, huh, I wonder how these things are doing today. And so stuff that I want to buy here in the future, I just put in the cart and then put it down in the watched items. This is one I watched. I started watching this at $5.99. It's down to $3.99. Wow. And, I don't know what the right, at what point I'm assuming if I bought a router like this, I would probably get pretty good connectivity out to the shed.
Yeah. Right. Now I will say, one thing to think about is, do you really need to pay for the router capabilities? And like, not everyone needs a router, right? So for example, PFSense, that's my router. It'll always be my router. It'll always be hardwired. I don't need routing functionality ever out of a Wi-Fi thing. So I actually focus on what's the most bang I can buy for my buck for the wireless access point functionality, not necessarily routing functionality. Especially when you're trying to do like coverage of like outdoor, indoor, et cetera, and you get into these like mesh networks with two or three pods, like that's probably going to give you overall more coverage and speed than buying the monster all in one that also has to do the routing. Cause you don't really need to pay for the routing functionality if you have a router, solution already. And, I don't know.
Well, and I'm using Bitdefender as my router. I have a Bitdefender router, which is pretty old.
Right.
It's not the greatest Wi-Fi router in the world. It's from a secure device standpoint, it does what I'm looking for, right? And so I would want to replace it. They're not doing that anymore. They've gotten out of that business, and I'm not sure how much longer. This thing's eventually going to die.
And does it have a subscription on it? They're going to kill it one day?
It's got $100 a year subscription that gives me unlimited Bitdefender licenses, and I it's worked well for me. I really liked it. It was a niche product that they got into the market, created two of these things, and then we're like, I don't think we're gonna do this. I don't think the public wants to do these kinds of things. It's fairly complex, right? So I have been thinking along. By the way, that router that I showed, I didn't say what it was. It's a TP-Link AXE 16,000 quad band Wi-Fi 6E router. So that's the one I'm looking at. It's on screen if you want to watch the video. But I don't know if I need to go $400, but there's probably in that. And I would, Christian, I'll be honest with you, I would be looking for a router that has some residential security features of things I could, I don't want to build pfSense. I've done that. I've done those. I don't want to do it. I kind of want it built in, and I don't even mind paying a subscription service if I think they're actually doing the job, you know? So, yeah. Joe says the Ubiquiti U6 mesh is a great outdoor access point. I'll be honest, I probably need to get in a situation where I've got one antenna in internal, and then I can run Ethernet to the outside on an outdoor access point that sits on the deck that just blasts over to the shed. That probably would get the job done, I would think.
Yeah, I don't see why not.
Yeah. Brian says they've been using a TP-Link Wi-Fi 5 router, 3-piece set. So far, so good. No need to upgrade yet.
Yeah, I'm still on, I think, Wi-Fi 5 as well. And it's getting a bit flaky. It's actually the same access point I've had since college. So it's starting to show its age. But yeah. I flashed the OpenWrt stuff on it quite some time ago. And yeah, it's still doing its thing.
Yeah.
But you can definitely there's sometimes you wake up and it's like, huh. And you got to turn the Wi-Fi off on your phone and magically the LTE is better. And then like you turn it back on a couple minutes later and everything's back to normal. And you're like, yeah, maybe it's time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Every time I get up to it and I'm like, do I really want to spend $600 on something that's like, it works.
Right. And like, right.
I don't, you know, I'm complaining about the, you know, 3% of the time it's being annoying because, but you know, the vast majority of my, you know, intensive internet stuff I'm hardwired for. So it's like, do I really need it? Maybe not. So I'm I'm waiting for it to get like dead so that I can just be like, all right, well now I have to.
But. Is it better? Just wait for it to die, or is that something like you'd want to have be putting in?
I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean,
good question. Especially in my case, the router, then I got to set everything back up again. See, that's the, with pfSense, you're just going to take some things down. You won't have connectivity. You're going to bring that device back up.
Yeah.
You're going to assign it to pfSense and you're back in business. And, often, yeah. Yeah. No, I go back. I go back and forth because it's another piece of equipment to maintain. Yeah. You could have a small box somewhere, right? Or a VM on another piece of equipment or whatever. But it's, I could be running it on the Unraid server. I mean, there's so many things you could be doing with it. But it is, that's the question I ask myself, especially on that. Do you risk a day or two of downtime when it goes and you're like, all right, then I got to go buy it, wait for it to come in. You're without those capabilities for a while, you know? Joe says, if I were waiting for my original router to die, I'd still be using a Linksys WRT54G.
Remember that brings back some fond memories,
doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does.
I never did. I had a couple of those. I could never flash them.
Those things were amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. They were.
What a staple of the early 2000s.
Well, and when they built those things, they actually used good chips. And then the stuff we got after it was just the absolute worst chips. You know, I was always, you know, after about a year, I was burning these things out every year because I was running so much traffic through them. I'm sure those chips were just heating up to the temperature of the sun in there and then just, you know.
But can you, Joe's saying he just pulled one out of his parents' house. That's how durable those things were. Those things were,
I might have one in a drawer. I'll be honest, back here, there may be one in this drawer right here.
Do you remember that they used to have them in stacks?
Yeah,
you could stack them. And you could stack them. Oh my gosh. That's a
little blue, nostalgic. Blue and gray, right? Dark gray. Yeah. That's a good looking. That was a good looking. Those were
you felt like you were like the Enterprise, you know, you had it all when you had the stack.
Yeah. No, you did. You did.
Jeez.
Well, interesting that you got me thinking, you know, I'm getting to that point where the router's going to go at some point. It's just a matter of time. And, he said they had switches that stacked. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Oh no, that was the whole, it was a sexy looking box. I mean, it looked like you were in a server room, right, of the day, whatever. So, Christian, before we wrap it up, we can't get out of here without a quick AI discussion. We have some, you mentioned it at the edge, you know, as being on the edge of things, but anything new in AI that you're paying attention to?
I think I teased a bit in the last show to start watching, the transition into like AI chips in local compute. And we're starting to see that play out a little bit, but in interesting ways, right? So there are several vendors like Intel and others that are doing the whole integrated NPU or neural processing unit, which is basically the dedicated AI chip. But one of the things that I found really interesting that I think the consumer needs to keep their eye on is NVIDIA is basically saying, screw the NPU. The GPUs are still crushing performance of any of these NPUs, and we're not seeing the need to have PCs have this separate chip because our GPUs are going to be able to do it all. I would watch that because that's a very interesting market decision that has to be fought out across consumers in the business, right? But I still think you're going to be seeing NPUs in smaller mobile and onboard platforms that are going to then need to do local AI. But for the desktop specifically, I think it's like still very much up for grabs.
Desktop. Also, laptop, would you throw laptops in the same?
Yeah, probably as the transition point. Yeah, maybe the integrated GPU is still enough. If you were
using an ARM processor, would you go with an NPU?
Probably at the point you're in ARM, yeah. Now, of course, I'm sure Apple's going to tell me that's stupid, and they're going to come out with the M. They're probably going to come out with the M4 chip with ARM and be like, yeah, no, you're completely.
It's
wrong.
Integrated on the same bus,
yeah.
And
So that's always possible. I do think that, you know, even with laptops, you can get, you know, you can get an NVIDIA integrated GPU if you want. They're a bit bigger, they run a bit hotter, et cetera, but still possible. But I would watch that. The other thing I would watch is the annual update for Windows 11 should be here in a couple months. And I think that will kind of be a glimpse into some of the AI features they're trying to get right for Windows 12. So I don't know if excitement is the right word, but I am kind of bubbling with curiosity to see if Microsoft's really going to, you know, all the things we've talked about in the last couple shows that I've been on around, you know, how Explorer is still kind of in the ice age from the perspective of like, how are we integrating, in this case, Copilot and other things to make this stuff easier and get out of keyboard mouse and get into AI and voice. I'm kind of curious to see if they pull something off with Windows 12. And I think we'll get early indications with this annual release of the Windows 11 update to see what they're thinking. So I would be watching that as well.
Are you using on Windows 11 for your endpoints?
Yeah. So that's a horrible story, but, the short story is that you'll all remember I built the desktop that replaced Flamethrower in 2020 as a COVID project. And it's got, you know, it was all the cool hardware at the time. I had a 5950X in it, and I did the 3080 RTX and 64 gigs of RAM, whole works. Well, to make a long story short, my backups started getting corrupted going to the domain controller for about a month. And I thought that was kind of weird. And then I I stopped being able to get Windows updates to apply, and I thought that was kind of weird. And then I stopped being able to get SFC scan now and all these other things to be able to repair. So I was up the creek without a paddle because I didn't have a good backup. I didn't have a good idea of what the heck was going on that was bit rotting my PC. Well, come to find out that I use RAM cache, which is a built-in ASUS feature, and I had four RAM chips, and three of the four RAM chips went bad. I've never had that happen to me before.
Wow.
Where three of the four chips were just shot. But Memtest 86 proved it pretty quickly. And then, of course, because I was RAM caching my hard drive on top of bad memory chips, mm-hmm. it was slowly writing things back out of that RAM cache to the hard drive that were absolute garbage. So then I'd start getting these random reboots. And, well, basically all of this became a forcing function that I upgraded to. I restored the machine to the last backup that kind of worked and still had bit rot problems, but I restored it enough that I could then run a repair install or repair upgrade to Windows 11. So the only way I could truly unbrick myself and get all back to normal was to upgrade to Windows 11, which sounds crazy, but it's the second time it's happened to me. The same thing happened to me. That's how I got onto Windows 10. I was a holdout for Windows 7 for a long time. And I had the same kind of, and I don't remember what the exact hardware failure or set of bit rot circumstances was with Flamethrower, but it was the same thing. So Flamethrower is still running Windows 10. It will just go into the sunset on Windows 10. But yeah, this box is now on Windows 11 Pro, and it's been fine. I mean, it's been a neutral upgrade for me. Like there's nothing I like love or hate about it. So I love that my PC is stable and not randomly rebooting and getting worse. And I did rip out all the G skills and replace them with two Corsair chips, which was the move. Yeah, there hasn't been anything that like wows or impresses me about Windows 11 so far. So no, maybe I just have a high bar, or maybe it's just more lipstick on Windows 10, but
they've rebuilt a bunch of stuff, replaced a bunch of things, and it changed the UI just a little bit. And
right. But my thing is like, tell me how it's making my life easier and more productive. And I feel like there's not a great answer.
No.
And that's how I measure them now, which sucks, but like I expect them to provide a stable OS that does gaming and all these other things really well. And like, if that's the baseline, then tell me something I don't know, right? Like what do I want to be excited about here that is, you know, measurably different? And I'm not sure that they...
No, it's just keeping it fairly stable. I mean, it's a complicated OS. It's got its problems. But I've been running various versions of it. I think everything I have now is Windows 11. I bought a laptop that is my shed laptop. I take it out there when I'm out, out at the smoke shack. And that had been Windows 10 I bought it from Gallup and they gave it to me with Windows 10. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to upgrade it. And then the other day I was looking at it. I'm like, man, this thing looks old. Like it's just, I've been using Windows 11. Now I use Windows 10 at work. So my work laptop is still Windows 10, but it was one of those kinds of things. You're like, in no Windows 11 instance is the same. That's the thing about Windows 11. Like depending on when you installed it and what what version you're on, they're all a little bit different, And so I think it's fine. I think for most people it's fine. Right. They just work. It still works. I haven't run into any issues with Windows 11 for what I do for it. I don't do a ton on them, but, 23 or 24H2, I think is the version you're talking about that's coming, and that'll be a precursor or something close to Windows 12, if that's what they're going to call it. Nobody really knows yet where they're going with those things, but 23H2 is the kind of the current build that folks are on. It seems stable enough and does what I need it to do. Just the look's a little bit different,
Mm-hmm.
The Windows bar came over to the middle. you go, I don't know. And then they throw in some funky, they got this slide in nav bar now that comes out from the right. And it's really, it's not a nav bar. It's an ad bar, you know? And you're like, oh, what are you guys doing? You know, they've sold out to ads and stuff. So that is, listen, that is probably one good reason not to go Windows 11 is all the ads. Windows 10 does not have them for the most
part. Which is funny because I don't see them, which must be because PF Blocker is doing its thing.
It's very possible. Yeah, it's very possible. Yeah. They've got, they're just trying to be helpful.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure. It's all charity.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyways. Well,
have you used Copilot Preview at all on Windows 11?
Yeah. Yeah. And we've got a version of an internal version of it, that we can use where it's protected. And so our data is not going out, which is kind of cool. And I still go kind of between ChatGPT and Copilot. Mm-hmm. And what I'm finding is I'm not using it as much as I thought I was going to, you know, and I guess I just don't do a lot of writing. I mean, it does a lot of summary and writing pretty well. Although it's writing is, you can spot a AI written article pretty fast.
Yeah.
In a complicated world. If it ever says in an ever changing or ever complicated world, AI right there. That is the, seems like that's the ChatGPT wants to start with the world, right? Every sentence, mm-hmm. You know? So I don't know. What about you? Where are you finding it being helpful for you?
I have not. I asked the question in part because I just see it shows up in my taskbar now, the Copilot Preview, but I've actually not used it yet. So
oh, yeah.
I'm just curious if
yeah. It's not bad. Yeah, it's not bad. It does some silly things. It can be helpful for summarizing things. You can throw a whole bunch of it. And I don't know if it's because of our enterprise relationship or what, but we get the ability to, we have an 18,000 token, 18,000 character token that they call notebook. And you can feed it a bunch. You think 18 is a lot. It's not that much, just to be honest. But you can give it a lot of data and then say, you know, do some sentiment analysis on it or tell me. I've noticed in the store, in the Amazon store, they've got AI summaries of all the reviews that they're putting above the review section. So if you go down to customer reviews, it'll say customer say, and then it's got a summary of all the things, both good and bad. And then it says AI generated from the text of customer reviews right there on the page. That's what these models are good at, is that kind of summarization stuff, right? And so I think that's a perfect application of AI in this area. You know, this router we were looking at has, you know, 2020 global ratings, and I probably not that many written ones, but say it did. Summarizing 20,000 or 2,000, sorry, summarizing 2,000 comments, getting sentiment analysis, and then splitting it up in a way that makes sense for a human to say, this is what most people are saying is good, and this is what most people are saying is bad. Pretty helpful.
Yeah. I mean, I are you using audio with it at all, or is it all text input?
Well, I use audio with it. No, otter.ai, that service, we feed audio into it. Decipher is no. Not Decipher. Descript. There we go. Descript is another service where it's using the AI to do the translation and then supposed to kind of overwrite, because the problem with translations is they're terrible. They transliterate, or they try to get as close as you can to the actual what's being said, except it doesn't make sense. Well, let the LLM fix that. It's picking the best word. By the way, you've given it 95% of the clues. So like, hey, just clean this up to what it should be or get it close. Man, AI could do a great job of taking a an AI translated a voice, and then cleaning up the, you know, making a second run at it to clean it up. It'd be really good at that, I would think.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
I'm saying, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ooh. So that's what, in my world, that is, I've been using Microsoft's translation tool to listen to the podcasts that we do in other languages in real time. That's gotten pretty good. Yeah. That's gotten really good. Like, it's amazing how good that is. And, and then the other day I had to play back the voice in my ears. And in my, why did I have to say in my ears?
Like, I don't know. I was wondering, are you hearing voices, Jim? I was wondering.
That's the dumbest thing I've said, at least in the last minute, maybe. And that was helpful too, you know, to, cause then I could be doing other things and listening, and the AI voice is pretty good. They actually let you listen to it in different accents now too, which is kind of cool. So you can choose, you know, like what I'm doing, and I want a deep male voice that has a slight accent so it doesn't get mixed up with maybe some of the other things that are going on around me. And so it seems to work out pretty well. That kind of stuff is cool. I think that's where it's going to get more and more helpful. But take a transcript, have the transcription engine, take the audio, transcribe it as it hears it. Then run AI over the top of that and say, hey, fix this to what you think is the most likely word that was put there based on the clues around it. I think it's going to get it right 99% of the time at that point, unless it just can't hear the word. But even then, maybe it fixes it, right? And LLM is pretty good at that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyways. Yeah. Joe says, before we go, he goes, that's problematic at weeding out fake reviews. And that's very true. If you're getting fake reviews, that gets added into the data. And it says, and people that leave bad reviews just don't understand the product. Yeah. No, Joe, absolutely. In other words, if you throw bad data into an LLM, you're going to get crap. But on a product like this, where I was looking at it, it might help summarize some things for me up front. Then I can go into the individual reviews and see. I'm not going to ask you, Christian, but I mean, bad reviews or fake reviews are a real issue. And so, you know, there's that there's always, that's always going to be like the poor. They're always going to be with us. So you just, I'm sorry. Sorry to throw the Jesus reference in there. That was probably uncalled for, but
it's okay. we got it immediately.
I'm not sure everybody did, but
yeah,
but,
well, not yeah. Yeah. Fair enough.
That's all right. That's all right. Anyways, Christian, anything else before I wrap it?
No, I think it's a wrap. It's been a fun wandering through the topics tonight.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was good. It actually helped me think through some things on the Wi-Fi side of things. And when I first saw that headline, private 5G, I was like, what? So that was super good. Well, thanks for coming out tonight. Always great to have you on here. And I will remind you, we talked about Maple Grove Partners up front, but they do host and sponsor the show. And so if you want to get high speed, reliable hosting, both media what's the word I'm looking for? Both media and web hosting. There you go.
That's right. For people there it that is.
Just went out. Visit maplegrovepartners.com. Check it out. That's Christian. And he's got some smacking plans for you out there and get you set up. And have you, somebody asked me the other day about converting, like taking a Squarespace. Is that the right word? Squarespace? Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah.
In converting that to like WordPress,
you can do it, but there's no like one click tool that's like export from Squarespace and import to WordPress, at least not that I've used.
Okay. All right. You just punted. You're like, no.
Yeah. You know, it's funny too, because I, it's really been a while since I've done, you know, I've been out of the web design world for long enough now where, I do still have people that are like, hey, can you design a website for me? And I'm like, no, I just can't. I just can't. Yeah. Let me refer you to someone who can help. But like, I'm not, I just can't do it anymore.
I wouldn't, even with WordPress, I'm not sure I'd want to set up a new one. Like, you know,
it's like, you know, there's properties. I mean,
we're unselling your service, by the way.
But. Yeah, it's fine. It's fine. It's at least, you know, you're dealing with someone really honest and that, you know, I'll give you what you need and I'll tell it to you.
You'll straight, get the hosting. Right? We'll take care of the hosting for you.
Yeah. We'll give you excellent hosting. Like if you need help with like particular like plugins or SEO or backend stuff, like sure. But like, if you want like someone that's going to design you a big, beautiful website, like we're just not doing it anymore. But where was I going with that? WordPress as an ecosystem is really flexible, really cool, but it can be overwhelming for people that are trying to do complex stuff. And they're like, oh, but there's like 20 plugins to choose from. And well, which one do I choose? And how do I get my workflow of things right? And so as powerful as WordPress is, I really find that less is more, and teaching people that less is more in WordPress is a really hard thing because they're like, oh, but I can click this install button. I can click this one. Next thing you know, they're like, my website's acting a little funny. Could you take a look at it? And I'm like, well, you got like 45 plugins installed and then you like installed this caching plugin on top and like, it didn't all mix very well. It's, less is more. And that lesson applies in life as well. If you want a WordPress with 40 plugins, we'll host it for you as high speed as it'll get. And, we'll make it work. But
it is dangerous because like when I go to refresh plugins, on your hosting, it's fast. It's like, boom, boom, done, boom, boom, done. I mean, they're there and it's just done. And
it's addicting.
It is. Yeah. You're like, oh, we could put a few more on here. This thing runs fast. which I just don't do. I did the other day. I pinged you. I was having some trouble doing some updates and I was using Edge and it just wouldn't work. And I was like, okay, what's going on here? So I ping you within about, I don't know, half an hour. You get back to me and you're like, hey, try this, try that. I'm not seeing anything here. Come to find out it's Edge. That I go over to Brave and it's working just fine. So I
it's got to
troubleshoot why that's not doing it on Edge.
It's funny. Randy had the same issue like a couple of weeks later, and it was the same thing. He switched browsers and he was fine. What he told me was that he thought he had cleared his cookies, but he didn't. And when he cleared the cookies on the browser that wasn't working, 431 went away. So
okay.
I got to look at what the circumstances are in which a cookie gets corrupted to do that to WordPress. And that's all client side. That's not server side.
Right.
But maybe try clearing cookies on Edge and seeing if that makes it go away. Cause
clearing cookies is so painful.
Yeah.
For me, I'm lazy. Like I like my cookies. I don't want them to go away because I got to redo I got to re-sign back into everything.
No, that's fine. It's fine. You use Bitwarden, you autofill all your passwords.
I know.
No cookies. No. this could be a whole nother show, but
big bucks, no whammies.
I use NoScript again now. So all my web pages by default load with no JavaScript. And then I've created this allow list over time that works pretty well for what I need. So I block all sorts of crap, man. Like it's great. Super fast browsing that way too.
When I'm doing the podcast, I have about 9 sites that I go to and manually upload the podcast to it. And I only do it because I do ask the podcast coach and I want to stay up to date on these services. And you know, some of them get hundreds of listens a year. So why not throw them out there? When I clear cookies, I got to manually, not manually because I use Bitwarden, but it's still a pain to go back and re-sign in, re-authenticate 2-factor to some of them. It's like, ugh. So anyways. Because we talked about it, I will clear my cache and cookies this weekend.
Excellent. Let us know.
And, we'll see if it works. If you want to leave us a message, you can head over to homegadgetgeeks.com and click the button 30 seconds on the message. If you want to send me an email, jim@theaverageguy.tv. And if you want to join us in the Discord group, The Average Guy, the nicest Discord group on the internet, theaverageguy.tv/Discord. We are live every Thursday, not every, but most. 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, out here at theaverageguy.tv. If you follow me on Discord, I'll give you the direct YouTube link so you can just come straight over here. In fact, tonight I just realized I never went to the live page and replaced the code. So it's showing our live page. Everybody that's here came in directly on YouTube, which is fine too. You guys can do that as well. We'll be back next week. I'm working on Gavin. I'm hoping he says yes, but we'll have another guest for you next week. With that, we'll say goodbye, everybody.
Good night.